Okay. Can everybody hear me if I'm. Do I need the microphone or can I just talk? Okay, cool. Well, thanks very much to everybody on the panel for deciding to put this together. And Antoine in particular, this was one of those post-workshop bar conversations where we said, hey, that's where all the important stuff at ISA happens, right? It's all in the bar. So we are having a discussion about, hey, you're doing this and we're doing that. And that's kind of cool. And we should sort of get together and talk about these things. So it's nice to be able to have an opportunity to sort of do this. And it's also kind of interesting because this has been the relationship between relational theory and complexity science has been sort of puzzling me for years. And it's been puzzling me, I think, in particular because of a couple of things that are kind of biographical. One of them is that I have a math background before I started doing what I do now. So I hear complexity and I go, ooh, right, chaotic nonlinear dynamics and Lorentz attractors. Cool. Okay, right, we can work with this stuff. So I kind of get that. And I remember going to a panel years ago with complexity in the title where this guy is presenting and he's getting up and talking about simulations. And I'm thinking, wow. IR must be a weird field if you can like play computer games and call that research. That's cool. What's going on there? And this obviously was at the early stages of stuff. But it kind of occurred to me, okay, that would make great pedagogy for sort of teaching you certain things about world politics, but I was kind of curious as to how that would be research practice. So that was kind of puzzling to me. I was also kind of puzzled because it seemed to me, floating around in the field in the early 1990s, that or the mid-1990s, that there were a lot of people talking in terms that sounded very different in terms of their presentation style, but seemed to have the same kind of underlying conceptual commitments. And in particular, I was thinking of two things that didn't obviously seem to go together. And Dan Nexon and I were talking about this fairly intensely at Columbia. We had, on the one hand, we had people doing network theory and starting to do kind of network theory and network models. And of course, right, we're at Columbia, so of course you've got all these people so down in the sociology department who were doing this stuff, people at the Lazarsfeld Center, so like people doing network theory. And then in IR, you've got all these post-structural theorists. And we're kind of listening to these people saying, well, actually, you're talking about very similar kinds of things here. There seems to be some kind of underlying connection or similarity between these post-structural discourse turn, linguistic turn kinds of approaches and what social network folks are doing. Now, the problem is you use entirely different vocabularies, and so the crosstalk would be very, very difficult to put together. And we discovered this by going to various presentations, trying to bring up the opposite thing and having the people kind of look at us like we were crazy, going, what are you talking about, huh? So out of this sort of morass of conversation came this 1999 EJIR piece that Dan and I wrote, which is incredibly turgid, but does make, I think, the important point that whatever a turn toward a focus on relations is, that turn is methodologically independent. That there's some, it's not a methodological claim that we're making. We're making some sort of a conceptual or what I would, in my current language, call a scientific ontology kind of claim. So it's a claim about objects and a claim about how we should study objects. It was not a claim about epistemology. It was not a claim about the status of knowledge. It was a claim about something else. And so we sort of attempt to work our way through this and articulate what is common between these things. And I don't want to try to, spend a lot of time summarizing what it is that we did in that piece, because I actually think that Neil unintentionally did a really great summary of what we were doing in that piece. And in fact, almost nothing that Neil had to say sounded to me like complexity science and sounded to me an awful lot like relational theory, for reasons that I'll talk about in just a second. But so I'm just going to sort of leave that aside. But I think that there are some things, obviously, that are kind of similar. Before I talk about similarity, let me just highlight the sort of the one major apparent difference, which a couple people on the panel have already talked about. Relational theory and people who self-identify as doing relational processual theory are not usually engaged in modeling and simulation exercises. Whereas people who are talking about complexity theory are often or perhaps generally engaged in some kind of computational simulation modeling exercise. I'm going to suggest that that is a really important difference. But it's a really important difference of technique. And it's not a really important difference of fundamental kind of scientific ontology about what we think the world is made of. It's a difference in how we think about analyzing it. And that's related to a set of philosophical ontologies about how sort of knowledge is produced. And those, in turn, are related to the histories of where relational theory and complexity science come from and how they got imported into the field of international relations. But so the main difference is kind of this presentation stuff in terms of whether it's a simulation exercise and modeling exercise on the one hand, or a sort of thick historical, detailed empirical story, which is kind of contingent on the other. Those are sort of apparent differences, what's similar here? Well, we've heard some of this. Let me just kind of draw a couple of them together. I think ultimately what's going on here is that relational theory and complexity theory name very similar kinds of scientific ontologies. To be relational or complex means to focus on essences rather than bonds. That's what I meant. I typed it wrong here. Type on bonds rather than essences, and on transactions rather than on categories. So what causes something to work in a particular way is not that it belongs to some abstract class, but that it has certain concrete transactions between it and something else. The famous example from the sociology literature is about the function of race and its relationship to poverty. It's not that your blackness makes you poor in an inner city. It's that the ways in which people who happen to be of a particular ethnic group are related to one another and to the surrounding economic system generates systematic poverty. Right, so it's not about dispositional essences causing things, it's about something else. So in other words, both complexity theory and relational theory are very interested in these sort of temporary stabilizations, hardenings of social flows, boundary crossings, and boundary transactions. Right, those are the kind of things that they direct us to look at. Now, another major similarity, I think, here is that relational theory and complexity science, the kind of explanations that they generate incline much more toward an embrace of contingency rather than toward necessity or generality. So we have much less in the way of law-like regularities and much more particular kinds of historical pathways. And I'm not going to go into why the notion of a power law doesn't violate that, because a power law isn't a law in a nomothetic sense. I'll just take my word for it. It's not about sort of, all right, let's name the elephant in the middle of the room. It's not about KKV, right? It's not about nomothetic law-like generalizations. And we're all about opposing that, right? So they're very similar on this. But there is this oddly persistent kind of difference when it comes to methodology in terms of how we analyze these things, these processes, these transactions that we all think are tremendously important. So there's this strange difference as a couple of people here have described, is when they have a puzzle in the complexity science, if you have a puzzle, what do you reach for? You reach for your toolkit. The toolkit the complexity scientists reach for involve nonlinear system dynamics, it involves modeling, it involves simulation, it involves computations. And as a relational theorist, what the toolkit I reach for? I sort of reach for, well, first I, you know, reach for my Foucault, right? I reach for discourse analysis. I reach for sort of linguistic hermeneutics. I reach for my copy of Nicholas Rescher's Process Metaphysics, I reach for my Charles Tilly. I reach for my Tilly Taro and McAdam Dynamics of Contention, which talks about social mechanisms and how they concatenate over time. So we have this odd sort of persistent difference, which is kind of interesting. Now, why do we have this difference? I'm going to suggest that this is not because we're fundamentally at all opposed. I think this is because of different kinds of specific histories and trajectories through which the different, if we can call them approaches or schools, come to doing our empirical work. And the person who is incredibly important for my thinking on this is this gentleman by the name of Andrew Abbott, who's a sociologist at the University of Chicago, who wrote the single best book I've ever read about academic disciplines, if for nothing else than its cool title, which is Chaos of Disciplines, which is just awesome. His 2001 book, this is fantastic. This is the sort of thing everybody should read. I don't get any royalties from the book or anything, but I really like pushing it, especially for graduate students. This is a great introduction to what the heck is going on in your graduate training and why your graduate training is as weird as it is and why you end up with an advisor who sort of gives you sort of material, and even if you're really dramatically opposed to what your advisor is saying in a lot of ways, you still end up being shaped by them in ways that you might not notice until later on. So it's about these interesting kind of fractalization dynamics of how things move and shape over time. One of the points that Abbott makes, which is, I think, very, very important here, is Abbott is a real big partisan of the idea that how you get places intellectually matters even more than the destination. right? How you get there, because the way you come to a particular set of points, the way you navigate through a particular set of issues within an academic field or a discipline, it means that when you arrive wherever you arrive, you get there with a particular set of conceptual endowments, a particular set of conceptual problematiques, a particular kind of habit of thought, right? Which comes from the things you've been wrestling with. And starting in different places means that you might make very similar kinds of substantive claims, but you're going to be approaching those with very different mentalities, if you will. And complexity theory, as we've already heard, where does this come from? Well, this comes from the natural sciences. It comes from physics, biology, engineering, a lot of nonlinear dynamics work, which is starting to go on as soon as general equilibrium models for systems started falling apart in engineering in the 1950s. So this is old stuff, right? So all this stuff at Bell Labs, they start talking about information transfer, you know, way back in the 1950s. And they started going, oh, this is really neat. And so you have them starting to realize that, hey, you know, the math doesn't work the way we think it does. So they start developing this whole sort of parallel set of things. But that's where it comes from originally, and then sort of comes over through the Santa Fe Institute and ends up in IR, or making its way into IR. Relational theory didn't do that, right? Where does relational theory come from? Well, relational theory, as I mentioned, comes from process philosophy and pragmatism. So people reading Peirce and Dewey, and then Nick Rescher, who's probably one of the most influential and important contemporary process philosophers, has written a number of things on this. Where else does this come from? Social studies of science, Bruno Latour, actor network theory. There's some of that stuff that starts sort of making its way in. And, of course, post-structuralism, and in particular, the post-structural critique of structural functionalist approaches to social explanation. And by structural functionalist approaches to social explanation, I mean Parsons and Marx. So these are post-Marxist, post-Parsonsian ways of talking about how social order is produced and sustained. Notice what's conspicuously absent from what I've just sketched as a potted history of relational theory. Physics, biology, and computational science, right? That's not where it comes from. Now, these parallels have been noted before. Derrida, in one of his very early books on Husserl's theory of the origin of geometry, actually noted that there was some stuff going on in the natural sciences that sounded an awful lot like what he was arguing was going on within philosophy. And then there's this whole ensuing debate about the difference between undecidability and ambiguity, which sort of goes on for a while within some of the French intellectual circles. So the point is, these parallels have been noted before, but they're parallels. They're different tracks. They get similar places, but they get there through very different directions. And so when we come to the same puzzles, we think about them in somewhat different ways. And the if you want an IR kind of example of this, think for a moment about Lars-Erik Sederman and Tim Mitchell. All right? Both guys who are very interested in the problem of where states come from and the status of the state. So when Lars-Erik Sederman wants to analyze this, what does he do? He designs a simulated ecology and puts it into resource endowments and runs a bunch of simulations to see what kinds of things emerge out of this. Obviously, I'm simplifying here. But what does Tim Mitchell do? Well, Tim Mitchell starts drilling down to look at very concrete border transactions and ways in which very micro-level kinds of monitoring techniques in specific cases give rise to the effect of a whole order. Right, so he has this great riff in Colonizing Egypt about how the practice of drill produces the effect of an army. Right, so again, not that they're fundamentally incompatible claims, but very different toolkits and very different sensibilities about how we would go about analyzing these things. It's kind of interesting because I mentioned earlier that I think Neil was sort of was talking in more relational than complexity science terms. Neil's biography of London sounds an awful lot like what a relational theorist would do, where you're talking about very specific kinds of things being put together. And it's a very, very particular kind of contingent thing. There's not an awful lot there about sort of broad-scale simulation. Why this difference? Well, I think causally it's because of these sort of different trajectories. And I think what it matters in terms of our conceptual equipment is that these different trajectories have, in a sense, bequeathed, I love that word, they have bequeathed complexity science and relational theory different philosophical ontologies. And I want to be careful. It's philosophical ontologies I'm talking about as a difference here. What's the difference? Scientific ontology is about objects and what kind of objects we think exist in the world. Philosophical ontology is about classical mind-body problems. How does the mind, the observer, connect to the thing observed? And I think that complexity science and relationalism have tended to actually have very different philosophical ontologies when it comes into these things. Relationalism, right, tends to reach for what Weber would have called singular causal analysis. Very specific configurations or concatenations or conjunctures, pick your term, that produce very specific outcomes, period, end of sentence. No attempt to generalize beyond the specific case because it's all about specific cases and specific causal processes. Complexity science, on the other hand, reaches for dispositional mechanisms, even though those dispositional mechanisms are tended to be lodged at the emergent level of whole systems or interaction systems rather than at the individual unit level, which is why, in a sense, both complexity science and relationalism can be anti-essentialist, because we both think the idea of like explaining things by dispositional properties of units is silly. So, but it's just a question of what we reach for to actually do the explanation in question. To put this a slightly different way, what this means is that relationalism, as it's grown up in IR, has tended to lean toward a more analyticist understanding of how we do explanation, how we generate social knowledge, whereas complexity tends to lean more toward philosophical realism as a way of thinking about how we generate knowledge. So methodologically, very different things. It's odd because it makes relationalism sort of, in terms of philosophical ontology, closer to rational choice theory in some ways. Because rational choice theory says, okay, here's this set of abstract analytics that we don't actually think represents anything, but we're going to run it and sort of generate some insights with it. And there's a lot in a lot of relational work, you get something very similar. Here's some mechanisms, and we know it's not capturing everything. We're not trying to capture everything. We're going to do this, and we're going to just run this and see what we get. Whereas the move you get in the complexity science is much more the critical realist move. All right, how do we then start talking about these sort of bigger unobservable things that are sort of generally shaping what these interaction patterns look like? Right? Not in a law-like way, but in a dispositional way. So you have that kind of different baggage of philosophical ontology. So what's punchline? Punchline is that different kinds of research traditions or research communities or research agendas or whatever sort of language you want to use, except please, for the love of God, don't use the word paradigm or research program unless you actually mean it, which you don't. These kinds of approaches to things, these are generally constituted, I think, by combinations of philosophical and scientific ontological presuppositions. Right? So when we talk about complexity science, it's got a philosophical ontological set of commitments, it's got a scientific ontological set of commitments. Those two things are not necessarily linked. You can combine them in all sorts of interesting and bizarre ways. I think of something like Colin White's recent book on ontology and international relations. And Colin passes very quickly from a philosophical ontological position about the existence of an external mind-independent world to a very specific catalog of entities, actors, and processes. But there's no logical reason you have to do that. You could buy the catalog of entities, processes, and actors without buying the mind-independent world part. And similarly, you could buy the mind-independent world part and say, but those particular catalogs of what's in there is actually wrong. Right? So there's no logical connection between these two. In practice, they get conjoined by these intellectual journeys that people take, and they end up sort of coming up together. But we've got to remember that they are actually in some ways independent of each other. They can be combined in all sorts of ways. This would then produce a rather broad and diffuse tissue of relationships, alliances, focused disagreements, which is some of the most interesting stuff that goes on in academia, right, is not sitting in a room with people who agree with you, but sitting in a room with people who you disagree about really specific things, right, because that's where all the energy comes from. That's also where edited volumes and special issues and, you know, publications and therefore tenure come from. So it's part of the engine here. So that's the first point, that there are these separate sort of issues going on. The second point that I want to leave you with is to reinforce and underscore Matt's very important point here, which is that none of the stuff I've been talking about ontology is a theory. These are not yet theories. These inform theories. They inform the practice of theorizing, but they are not theories. To say things like, we're going to focus on transactions between entities, doesn't tell me anything about world politics. It doesn't tell me anything about anything. It does tell me that if I wanted to learn about world politics, I know what to look for now, or I have a sense of what I shouldn't look at and what I ought to look at and try to make my tools correspond to in some way, and that becomes the interesting sort of practical challenge that Matt was talking about, which we have on the relational side as well, right? How do you have a way of saying we don't want to reify things, but then we still want to actually conduct analyses, so we have to temporarily arrest stuff, and how much can you freeze things in order to set the rest of the model in motion? And it's that same basic issue, but we just use different kind of tools to do it. Ontologies inform our theories. They inform our practice of theorizing. So they basically guide and shape how we conduct our empirical research, but they aren't empirical claims about the world, and we do ourselves a huge disservice if we think that our ontologies are actually empirical claims about the world. They are, to use sort of Kantian language, they are transcendental presuppositions of how we conduct our empirical research about the world. But they're not actually claims about the world themselves, which parenthetically means they're not falsifiable. You can't test an ontology. That just doesn't make any sense, because what would you test it against, right? Philosophical ontology, mind-world, mind-body kinds of issues. Scientific ontology, catalog of objects and how we think objects exist. Those are important. Those need to be combined. We need to work out the kind of tensions between them. Concrete accounts of stuff means having to discuss specific objects and processes, and that's what empirical research is for. What gets interesting in the discussion about concrete research between relationalists and complexity scientists is that we may have our disagreements, and if I'm right, we do have our disagreements about philosophical ontology. But in terms of scientific ontology, we have a very similar way of thinking about objects and things that exist in the world. This then produces the possibility, if we can sort of work out some of the linguistic translation difficulties, of some really interesting back and forth. I agree with Matt that this is probably a lot of it going to take place under the auspices of constructivism, broadly understood, because it's real hard to square this stuff up with like neoliberal institutional understandings of people having like dispositional exogenous interests that propel them to do stuff. But I think that there's... Though, parenthetically, there's some interesting connections to certain kinds of realism, especially classical realism, I think, if you do it this way. George's probably going to talk about that a little bit. No? Okay, well, he might later. But I think that's where the interesting discussion comes, right? Because we have this similarity of scientific ontology, even though we have sort of profound divergences about philosophical ontology. That produces the possibility, at least, of a really interesting, focused set of empirical conversations, which is what I would love to see sort of be the result of these kinds of dialogues. So, and I will stop there.